Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 9, Chapter 9, Text 13 to 14. Text 13. Simply by having water from the Ganges come in contact with the ashes of their burnt bodies, the sons of Sagara Maharaj were elevated to the heavenly planets. Therefore, what is to be said of a devotee who worships Mother Ganges faithfully with a determined vow? One can only imagine the benefit that accrues to such a devotee. Text 14, translation by Srila Prabhupada. Because Mother Ganges emanates from the lotus toe of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Anantadev, she is able to liberate one from material bondage. Therefore, whatever is described herewith about her is not at all wonderful. It has actually been seen that anyone who regularly worships Mother Ganges simply by bathing in her water keeps very good health and gradually becomes a devotee of the Lord. This is the effect of bathing in the water of the Ganges. Bathing in the Ganges is recommended in all Vedic Shastras, and one who takes to this path will certainly be completely freed from all sinful reactions. The practical example of this is that the sons of Maharaj Sagara went to the heavenly planets when water from the Ganges merely touched the ashes of their burnt bodies. Om Agyanitam Randasya Ginanjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Jaina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shiva Sadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Nahyetad Paramashchayam Svardunyaya Dihoritam Ananta Charanam Bhoja Prasutaya Babachidaha. Because Mother Ganges emanates from the lotus toe of the Supreme Personality of Godhead Anantadev, she is able to liberate one from material bondage. Therefore, whatever is described herewith about her is not at all wonderful. So this is the conclusion of the section glorifying Mother Ganges, the descent of the river Ganges. So Prabhupada is saying in the purport that he says, it has actually been seen that anyone who regularly worships Mother Ganges simply by bathing in her water keeps very good health and gradually becomes a devotee of the Lord. This is the effect of bathing in the water of the Ganges. So I was thinking there's many things that can be proven in life, and there's many things that can't be proven in life. And there's some things that can be proven by experiment. For example, in the field of engineering, there's certain things you can prove mathematically with pen and paper. You can prove things mathematically, how much stress is going to be on certain beams and things like that. But there's certain things that can't be proved mathematically. They can only be proved experimentally. And essentially, it's when things become too complicated, then you can only prove them experimentally. So I don't know if anyone's ever seen, if you have a building site and you have to build a new structure on the building site, you have to do soil tests. So what they do is they have a massive drill and they drill it down into the ground and then they pull it out. And when they pull the drill out, they have soil samples from all the way down at various depths. And they take those soil samples to a laboratory and they test them for how strong the soil is and whether the soil can take the weight of the building. Now, the reason they have to do tests is because you can't calculate the strength of soil mathematically. It has to be done experimentally because it's too complicated. There's too much involved. You can't say what the soil is capable of. So when things become complicated or when things become subtle in life, you can no longer prove things rationally. There's no rational proof. There's certain things you can prove with logic and with reason, but when things become too subtle, there's no proof for it. But there is a proof, and the proof is experimental. So, for example, there was a debate years ago, quite a few years ago. Shiva Ram Maharaj was debating in a university with a scientist. He called himself an atheistic scientist. And he kept making that point. He said, we have an experiment, he said. He gave the philosophy of Krishna consciousness very nicely. And he said, you have to try the experiment. try the experiment. Try chanting the holy names as an experiment and see does it make a difference in their life. And Prabhupada uses that example. It's in the Journey of Self-Discovery. Personally speaking, that's what inspired me when I read that book. He said, try it for a week, you know. Just try it. Try chanting the Maha Mantra for a week. See if it makes a difference in your life. So I tried it, and it did. So it was an experiment. So we can do an experiment. We can bathe in the River Thames every day for whatever amount of time, you know, 3 months. And we can see, do we keep very good health? And do we become a devotee of the Lord? Or do we get Wheels disease and end up in hospital? So anybody who's visited the Ganges and spent time in the Ganges can attest to the fact that actually by bathing in the Ganges, it increases our devotion for the Lord. It's just something, there's no proof for it, but the proof is try it and see, just do it. And as for keeping good health, people, you know, sometimes people in the Western world turn their nose up at Indian rivers. They say they're dirty and all that. But it's described in the Nectar of Instruction that a devotee ignores the whatever may be floating in the holy rivers. But the river still gives good health. And the river, I'll just say that because I've had the opportunity twice to engage in some near-death experiences with Parashuram on the Ganges. He does his Ganges trip with a homemade boat. So we went from Dev Prayag. That was one of the trips I was on, starting from Dev Prayag, which is the confluence. I believe that's where, like, one of the official starting places of the Ganges, where a few tributaries come, and then the Ganges is the Ganges. And going up there, the Ganges is about 10 feet deep, at least 10 feet deep, and it's crystal clear. You can straight through to the bottom. And you can drink the water from the Ganges. One devotee said to me before I went, he said, when he went to the Himalayas and he drank the water from the Ganges, he said he never thought he could have such an experience by drinking water. And I thought, oh, okay. And then I went there and I drank some water and I thought, God, I've never had such an experience from drinking water. The water of the Ganges is not, you know, it's not ordinary, especially in that place up in the Himalayas, up high, before they start throwing dead bodies and sewage into our waters further down. But aside from the fact that, you know, there's quite a large amount of pollution gone into the River Ganges, and aside from the fact that much of the water of the Ganges River is there's a big dam, and they've taken the water away for irrigation, and there's only a very tiny amount of Ganges water which comes through. Still, you can't look at the Ganges water from a gross point of view in that way, because people make this argument. They say, oh, the Ganges is not even the Ganges. And they say, sometimes they say now the Yamuna is not even the Yamuna anymore because it's all effluent from industry in Delhi. But you can't say that. We can't say that because the Ganges, it's not the physical water that makes up the Ganges. The Ganges River is something different. It's something different. The potency of Mother Ganges is present in the water of the Ganges. And it's not something that can be proven logically or rationally, but it is something that can be experienced. So to try and understand it, a bit more, every pastime in the Bhagavatam, there's two levels to the pastime. There's the katha, which is the story, the pastime, and there's the tattva, which is what we're supposed to see spiritually through the story of you know, all the lila in the Bhagavatam is like that. Because originally the Vedas, the Vedic literature, the Upanishads, they give direct spiritual knowledge, But given the condition of living beings in this age, Vyasadeva decided to, he compiled the Puranas, the histories, and the Srimad Bhagavatam, the Mahapurana, and Mahabharata, and he compiled them for people like us, who don't have the head for getting into like direct tattva. It's too deep. The Upanishad's knowledge is too much for people like us. So he presented it in by means of pastimes, like real pastimes of the Lord. But those pastimes have a message also, not just in the sense of... not just in the sense of a moral, like you have these, sometimes there's these stories they call Aesop's Fables. I don't know if it's just me or if they're famous, but Aesop's Fables, you have these little stories, kind of for children, and then at the end of the story there's a moral. The moral of the story is, if you're nice to people, people will be nice to you or whatever. But not in that sense. In the sense that the pastimes in the Bhagavatam and in the Puranas, they directly manifest certain spiritual truths. Certain spiritual truths. But if we don't go deeper into the matter, and if we don't see the spiritual truth which is being presented, then we're missing out, actually, on... there's a background noise. It's distracting. Oh, sorry. Apologies. Translation. So I was wondering why it stopped every time I stopped. So if we don't go deeper into the matter, then we have the benefit of the katha, we have the benefit of the pastime, but we don't get the full wallop of the message. So we have to go deeper into understanding what the pastime is. And I have an evidence for that, and the evidence is Bhaktivinod Thakur's summary study, Sri Krishna Samhita, summary study of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And he makes this point in there. And he says that all the demons, he says, Braj means the pure consciousness, the pure heart of the living entity, the pure consciousness of the living entity. That's what Braj is. And in Braj, the devotees are there and Krishna is there. And the relationship is going on in Braj, in the pure heart of the living entity. Now, into Braj comes demons. And the demons disturb the relationship between the Lord and the devotees. So each one of those demons represents a different anartha in the heart of the devotee. So the anarthas need to be removed. Krishna removes the anarthas, which means Krishna kills the demons. And when Krishna kills the demons, then you can see in the pastime that when the demon is killed, the devotees, their ecstasy increases. Because when the anarthas are cleared away, then the devotee comes closer to Krishna more and more, and there's more ecstasy involved. So there's two broad categories of killing of demons. One is demons which are killed by Krishna, and the other is demons which are killed by Balaram. So Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and Balaram is the reservoir of all living entities. He's called, in one verse here, the transcendental reservoir of all living entities. Because Balaram is the transcendental reservoir of all living entities, Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains in here that that means that the demons who Krishna kills, those anarthas can only be removed by Krishna. For example, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur wrote an essay about Vatsasura, and he said Vatsasura represents what he calls like the boyish desire, the youthful desire to enjoy physically, enjoy the body. So I think most devotees will have that experience of trying to give up physical desires, desires for sense gratification. And we try, and we try, and we try, and we try, and 20 years later, 30 years later, we're still trying, and they're still there. And the reason is, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, he says it very explicitly in that essay, he says the only way those desires can go is when Krishna kills the demon of Vatsasura. Krishna has to remove those desires, because those desires are too powerful for us to do. That's why... Bhakti is all about surrender. The key to bhakti is sharanagati. We're supposed to surrender to Krishna for his favor, and then he'll remove what needs to be removed. But because Balaram, Lord Balaram, is the transcendental reservoir of all living entities, that means that the demons which are killed by Balaram, that's up to us to remove those anarthas. There are certain demons, what those anarthas represent. So this book, Sri Krishna Samhita, there's another book Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote called the Sri Chaitanya Shikshamrita. And in there he has another list. He lists the demons and what they represent. For example, Prahlambasura. Prahlambasura represents the impersonalist desire, the desire for the liberation of complete merging, is Prahlambasura. So Prahlambasura represents the anartha of complete merging, because if we completely merge with Krishna, we can't have that rasa, that relationship with Krishna. So why is Prahlambasura killed by Lord Balaram? Because the living entity has the free will to choose his liberation. So it's up to us whether we want to follow the impersonalist path or the personalist path. We have that freedom. The freedom is with the living entity. It's not Krishna who dictates. Krishna doesn't kill Prahlambasura. Lord Balaram kills Prahlambasura. Means we have to do it. If we want the personal relationship with Krishna, we have to kill the anartha of complete merging with Krishna. So Denukasura is another devotee, demon, anartha, who personifies the ass of blunt judgment. And he was killed by Baladev. So the pastime is that Krishna and Balaram and the cowherd boys were herding the cows, and they got the aroma of the tal fruits from the Talavan forest, and they had a desire to taste those fruits, but they had a problem that the fruits were being guarded by Denuka. So they went there. There was a big fight. Lord Balaram wheeled Denuka around, threw him into the tops of the trees and killed him. And then all his associates were killed also. And the cowherd boys gathered the fruits and enjoyed the fruits. So Denukasura represents the ass of blunt judgment. That's the anartha that's being represented. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he says, subtle discrimination is extremely important for Vaishnavas. Those who invent social distinctions and preach the unbreakable principles of Vaishnavism while breaking them to suit their needs are said to possess gross discrimination. Now, what that means is, earlier on he's explained that the pure spiritual truth comes down through self-realized acharyas, and those acharyas present the truth to people like us. But because people like us were contaminated with material dualities, for that reason, when the pure truth is presented according to time, place and circumstance, we begin to think that the time, place and circumstance is important and the truth is not so important. So we think the clothes are important. We think the method of worship is important. He gives a whole list of what's not important. One of the things that's not important is tilak. He says different markings on the body are considered to be sectarian practices. So the point is, you have to have a system. You have to have a method of worship. You have to have certain practices. You know, these things are important, but we should know that if our emphasis goes on those things and not on the truth itself, then we've fallen victim to Denukasura. Because we haven't developed a subtle distinction to make the distinction between different groups of Vaishnavas, different groups of living entities. We're thinking everyone's different. Like in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Pritak Drishti, he says, one who is contaminated by the mode of passion, he sees different living entities according to their body. But one who's situated in the mode of goodness, he sees one spirit soul in all bodies. The spirit soul is the same. In the Bhagavad Gita, in chapter 13, text 20, last line of the paragraph, Prabhupada explains that all varieties with regard to living entities come from the body. As far as spirit is concerned, living entities are all the same, he says. Now, that's a whole thing, because although they're all the same, we all have individuality also. That's not disputed. But the point is, if we're seeing people on the external level, on the external platform, and we're making distinctions between different groups, then we're under the influence of Denukasura, is the point. Because subtle discrimination is extremely important for Vaishnavas. He says, those who invent social distinctions and preach the unbreakable principles of Vaishnavism while breaking them to suit their needs are said to possess gross discrimination. This gross discrimination takes the form of the ass, Denuka. The ass cannot eat the sweet palm tree fruits, and he opposes others' attempts to eat them. So somebody who's absorbed with gross discrimination, he can't taste the fruits, the higher fruits, the subtle aspects of bhakti. He can't taste it. And not only is he not satisfied in not tasting it himself, he tries to obstruct other devotees from moving forward. So in the same way that I think most devotees have the experience that when you want to come to Krishna consciousness, most materialistic people try to stop you. They try to stop you. And the devotees always then give the example, like if somebody's new to Krishna consciousness, they give the example, they're all like crabs, because if you have a box of crabs, and one of the crabs is trying to escape by crawling up the side of the box, the other crabs will grab him and pull him back down. So that's the nature of envy. That's the nature of the envy in this world. That happens with crabs, and that happens with people when you try to pursue a spiritual path. Materialistic people try to stop you. They say all kinds of things, you know. like my own experience, I was advised that if I join these people, he said, if you join these people, you're flushing your life down the toilet. And I said, God, Jesus, you know. I won't say who told me that. But, you know, we're not flushing our life down the toilet. We've got a fantastic opportunity to have a real life. So we come to Krishna consciousness. But you come to Krishna consciousness, everything doesn't happen straight away. We come to Krishna consciousness and we still have our gross discrimination. So when a devotee tries to make further advancement into the subtle realms of devotional service, then, I'm quoting Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he says, ass-like devotees who are simply interested in the regulated principles under the control of gross discrimination, ass-like devotees who are simply interested in the regulated principles will try and pull a devotee down when he's trying to go up. Because the envy is not gone. It's not that just because you wear the clothes and just because you join the institution, suddenly you're free from all the contamination of the material world. It doesn't work like that. We still have Denakasura inside. So we have to examine ourselves. Am I stopping myself from advancing in Krishna consciousness? That's why Lord Balaram kills Denakasura. Am I stopping myself? I have to allow myself to make advancement in Krishna consciousness. And if I'm not interested in tasting the fruits of the tal tree, the higher experience of bhakti, am I also trying to stop other people from going there? You know, am I acting under the influence of Denakasura? We have to examine ourselves closely. And Denakasura has to be killed. We have to kill it, Denakasura. So the ass-like devotees... It's important that he says ass-like devotees, because, you know, you think devotees are not ass-like, but we have ass-like mentality. The donkey is a physical, everything about him is gross and physical. It's just hard work and physical, that's it. There's no subtlety to him. But to enter into higher realms of devotional service means to develop subtlety. It's all about subtlety. It's the most subtle. Krishna says it explicitly in the Bhagavad Gita, Bhumirapa Unalobayu Kama no Buddhirevacha, Ahankara Itiya Me Bina Prakriti Rashtada. The eight external energies of Krishna, starting from the most gross, earth, water, fire, air, ether, they become more subtle. The mind is more subtle. The Ahankara, the false ego, is the most subtle of the eight external energies. Then Aparayamitaspanyam Prakritim Bidime Param Jivabhuta Mahabaho Yayedam Daryate Jagat. More subtle still is the jiva. And more subtle still is Krishna. So how subtle do we have to be to understand Krishna? If we're like a donkey and we're only interested in rules and regulations and physical work and, you know, everything practical and everything tangible, then how can you relate with Krishna? Krishna reserves the right to not be approached by people who are not qualified. The qualification means to manifest subtle discrimination. He says there, subtle discrimination is extremely important for Vaishnavas. So, ass-like devotees who are simply interested in the regulative principles and under the control of gross discrimination are unable to attain a higher platform. Vaishnava principles are so unlimitedly exalted that those who simply remain entangled in the regulative process, entangled in the regulative process, mind you. So we have the regulative principles of freedom mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita. So the regulative principles free us from the material world. But then at a certain point, we become entangled in the regulative process. Niyamagraha, isn't it? Niyamagraha. The nectar of instruction constitutes the first instructions for neophytes. That's in Prabhupada's introduction. The first instructions for neophytes. So niyamagraha, if you don't follow the rules and regulations, then you can't make advancement. But if you become entangled in the rules and in the regulated process, then you can't make advancement. So how do we become unentangled? How do we follow the rules and regulations without being entangled in the rules and regulations? Is a trick, isn't it? I mean, I hope I'm not alone in this experience of Jai Shri Shri Radha Gokulananda Ki Jai. In this experience of the coming and going, I think it's a natural part. Actually, it is a natural part. It's in the Madhurya Kadambini, Gana Tarala, in the neophyte stage, sometimes sick, sometimes thin, sometimes full of vigor for following the rules. And then you suddenly think, oh my God, I'm just absorbed in the rules. I better back off from the rules. And then next thing, oh, I'm not following the rules strictly enough. I better follow the rules again. Coming and going like that. So there's no solution to that on that level. There's no solution to that on that level. Like in the Madhurya Kadambini, the six types of anarthas, which are mentioned in the unsteady stage of bhajana kriya, unsteady stage of devotional service, the six different types of anarthas. So you have these problems, you know. So you expect, okay, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he's listed the problems. In the next chapter, he's going to list the solution. He doesn't list the solution. He just describes the next level. I don't know if anyone's noticed that. Like, you would think that it's like, you know, the room is really dirty, you know. So chapter one, what's the problem? The problem is the room's really dirty. Chapter two, what's the solution? The solution is clean the room. Chapter three, what's the perfection? The perfection is the room is now clean after cleaning it. So it's not like that. He just gives the problems. And then the next thing, he just describes that state beyond the problems. Now the point is, there's no way out of the problems through the problems. Because the problems are in the mind. The problems are when we're following the regulative principles with the mind, then we're stuck on that level. But when we go beyond the mind, then those problems don't exist anymore. That's the point. So how to cross over this? The solution is given here. He says that when those who simply remain entangled in the regulative process without endeavouring to understand the science of attachment are comparable to ordinary fruit of workers. So you're thinking this niyamagraha, I'm not following and then I'm following too much and I'm not following and then I'm following too much. So you're thinking, well, maybe I need a balance. How do I get the balance? But the balance comes when you try to understand the science of attachment. That's when the balance comes. The balance doesn't come by trying to balance the thing. The balance comes by trying to understand the process of attachment. Now, the process of attachment, the science of attachment, he says, the science of attachment means rasa, means raga or rasa, the science of attachment. So those who simply remain entangled in the regulative process without endeavouring to understand the science of attachment are comparable to ordinary fruitive workers. So prakrita bhaktas are comparable to ordinary fruitive workers. Because ordinary fruitive workers work for profit, and prakrita bhaktas work for profit. Because we've still got contamination. We're on the gross level. We're absorbed in the body. So in order to come out of the body, we have to understand the science of attachment. So, therefore, until the ass Denukasura is killed, one cannot advance in the science of Vaishnavism. Until Denukasura is killed, we cannot advance. And we have to kill him. And we have to kill him by understanding the science of attachment. And attachment means rasa. Attachment means rasa. And rasa, I was explaining last night, so forgive me for repeating, but rasa means, rasa is present, it's a part of the soul. There are certain qualities. Krishna has qualities. And he has qualities because, just because he has qualities. There's no reason why he has qualities. And one of his qualities is his existence. He exists for no reason. He just possesses existence. And another quality he possesses is rasa. They say the soul is Anandamaya Vyasat. The reason the soul is Anandamaya Vyasat is because Krishna is Anandamaya Vyasat. Krishna wants rasa. So in the same way that a drop of ocean water contains the same qualities as the ocean, the whole ocean, in the same way, the part and parcel of Krishna contains the same the qualities of Krishna. It contains independence. It contains free will. It contains existence. Contains rasa. So rasa is in the soul. Now, when the Atma, I'm going to try and get to this because this is the point here in the purport. When Atma is reflected into Prakriti, then false ego comes, ahankar is born. When ahankar reflects into the mind, reflects into sattvagun, then the mind is born. When ahankar reflects into rajagun, then the senses are born. When ahankar reflects into tamagun, then the gross elements and the body and the sense objects are born. But the first thing that's born in the material world, the first thing that manifests is ahankar. It's ahankar, false ego. Now, false ego is the manifestation, it's the reflection of the soul into the material energy. So when the soul becomes reflected into the material energy, then all the qualities of the soul also become reflected into the material energy. So when rasa becomes reflected into the material energy, then that rasa comes out in a perverted form, namely the desire for sense gratification. So our rasa at the moment is for sense gratification. Our rasa is for engaging the body in sense gratificatory activities. That's our rasa at the moment. So to understand the science of attachment means, like for example, I'll just mention in yesterday's class, the example was given that if a person has a valid reason for engaging in a certain activity, then they can engage in that activity, in any activity. If they can justify it as a good reason, then they'll do it. But actually, we see that there's many activities which are, just don't seem, you know, they're just, you know, why do people engage in those activities? Like the hog, for example, because all animals don't rationalize. Animals still engage in activity. So the hog engages in the activity of eating stool, and it loves it. It loves eating stool. Because the rasa is part of the soul. So when the rasa is coming out in that way, then if we have rasa, we'll act. That's why we're acting, is because we have rasa. There's no activity without rasa. That's why it's mentioned that the complete merging, that existence, there's not considered any activity there. Because they haven't got that development of rasa. There's a certain rasa in a dormant state, there's an experience of the unlimited nature of the absolute. But because rasa is suppressed, there's no activity. So the point in Krishna consciousness is that spiritual activities take place on the basis of rasa, and material activities take place on the basis of perverted rasa. So if we can understand the science of rasa, then when we act according to the principles, the regulative principles, then we're doing those regulative principles because of rasa, because it's because of the taste. There's some taste, and there's a taste of relationship with Krishna. So Krishna gets a taste, I get a taste. So because that rasa is there, then naturally we don't have this niyamagraha problem. Niyamagraha happens, the two sides, if we're following the rules and regulations too strictly, or if we're not following the rules and regulations enough, it's because there's no rasa in our Krishna consciousness. That's why. So if we can understand the science of rasa, the science of attachment, and we can engage in the practices of Krishna consciousness with some feeling, then niyamagraha is no longer a problem. We're balanced in our Krishna consciousness. And it's not that it's got, at some point in the future or whatever. Everybody has some feeling in Krishna consciousness. Everybody has some feeling in Krishna consciousness. We wouldn't be here. You know, you wouldn't follow the austerity of rising early, restraining the senses, following the principles of bhakti yoga. You wouldn't be doing it unless there's some kind of feeling there. So the point is not to ignore that feeling. The point is to fan that feeling and direct that feeling towards our Krishna conscious activities. And in that way, then that's called Raganuga Sadhana Bhakti. That's Raganuga Sadhana Bhakti. In simple terms, there's this whole thing, you know, it's like, things are like a dirty word to talk about Raganuga Bhakti and all this type of thing. No, that's for later. The thing is, to understand it properly in tattva, there's no offenses. There's no chance of offenses. If you're understanding something properly in tattva, in truth, there's no offenses. It's only if you're understanding stuff, you're not understanding it properly, but you're trying to follow it in a perverted form, so to speak, then it becomes this type of thing of like sahaja, and all these names come out, you know, and people say, oh, you shouldn't be doing that. But the point is, we should understand things in tattva and make advancement in Krishna consciousness. That's the point. We're not supposed to stagnate. We're not supposed to remain prakriti bhaktas for the rest of our life and then take another birth and then another birth and then millions of births. We're supposed to develop an attachment for Krishna and make advancement. Is that not why he came? You know, what's the point in him coming otherwise? Just to give us a load of rules. We already had rules. You know, I grew up in Ireland. I had those religious rules. You go to Mass on Sundays. You know, you go to confession. You say your prayers, whatever. We got plenty of rules. Krishna doesn't need to come to this world to give us a whole load of rules to follow. Krishna comes to the world to manifest his pastimes so that living entities become attracted to the pastimes and living entities develop this rasa and become liberated. Janmakarma chame divyam evam yo veti tatpataha chaktvadeham punar janma neti ma meti so arjuna. If we understand Krishna's pastimes in truth, tattva, then after we leave this body, we don't take another body here, we take a body there, a spiritual body. So, sorry, I'm running out of time, but I want to try and... the reason I'm saying all this was that the tattva... What's the tattva of this pastime? The tattva of Mother Ganges flowing into the material world. Who is Mother Ganges? It's described that Lord Mahavishnu is lying on the causal ocean. So when Vamanadeva pierced the covering of the material universe, water from the causal ocean flowed into the material universe, and that's River Ganges. So the Lord Mahavishnu is considered to be at the time of annihilation, all the living entities merge into the body of Mahavishnu. And Mahavishnu is lying on the causal ocean in the Brahma Samhita. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur explains, yoga nidram gataha, in the state of deep sleep, which is called the Sushrupti state, the state of deep sleep. Now, when all the living entities merge into the body of Mahavishnu, how do we get born again in new bodies? We get born again in new bodies because of our samskaras, because of our karma vasanas, our karma that's held in storage for us. Prabhupada explains in that way. You know, all the living entities, Mahavishnu breathes out, manifests the universe. When he breathes in, everything assimilates into his body in a dormant state. Then he breathes out again, and all the living entities become manifest again according to their karma. So where's the karma? Where's the karma stored? The accumulated karma of unlimited living entities, karma vasanas, is stored in an unmanifest state as the causal ocean. The causal ocean. It's explained in that way in the Vedic literatures. So the causal ocean is always turbulent because the mind is always turbulent. Mahavishnu is always completely shanti because he's in the state of yoga nidra. So everything that happens on a large scale is reflected on a small scale. So Lord Brahma, he has a partial devastation at the end of each day, and he has a full annihilation at the end of his life. Same as us, at the end of our life, we have a full devastation, and then a new body comes, a new universe, you know. This body is like our universe. So a new universe comes. But every night, there's a partial devastation. So what's the partial devastation? Is we go from the waking state, from Jagrat to Swapna to Sushupti, from the waking state to the dream state, and then from the dream state to the deep sleep state. So in the waking state, the body exists, the mind exists, and the soul is there. The body, the mind, and the soul are all there. In the dream state, the body's dissolved for us. Someone else may look and say, oh, you know, the body's lying on the bed. But for me, for our experience, the body's dissolved, the body's disappeared. So the mind exists, the mind is there, and the soul is there. So the soul is less covered in the dream state than in the waking state. We think the waking state is very real. It's so real. We think the waking state is the only reality, and all the other two states are just like, they're not really real. We think, oh, it's only dreaming. But Prabhupada says night dream and daydream. This daydream is less real because we have more illusion. We have the body, where the soul is covered by the mind and the body. In the dream state, the soul is just covered by the mind. And then in the deep sleep state, the mind dissolves. And when the mind dissolves, then only the soul is left. But the soul is covered by avidya, primeval ignorance, which means that we don't have the experience of self-realization in the deep sleep state. But we do wake up from the deep sleep state and we feel completely peaceful because the mind was gone and the body was gone. And that's where the idea of sannyas comes from in the Vedic tradition. Sannyas comes from the rishis observe this method. Karmis, fruit of workers, they think that by accumulating things we get satisfaction. But the rishis recognized that by giving up things we get satisfaction. You give up the body, give up the mind, you get satisfaction. So the self-realized state means to take the deep sleep state into the wakened state. It's called the Turiya state. The Turiya state means, the fourth state means that the soul has experience of his spiritual identity, even though the body is there and the mind is there. And in that state, then the body and the mind, they follow the dictation of the soul. And then we see thus manifest the symptoms, the external symptoms of a pure devotee. When a pure devotee moves in the world, the body and the mind are following the pure desire of the soul. So that's our partial devastation. And it's recommended in the Uddhava Gita, Krishna recommends to Uddhava that we should make the endeavor to analyze how it is that I'm passing from one state to another, all the time. We don't do that generally in life. In life we just wake up and we think, oh, I'm awake, I've got loads of stuff to do, and then we do it, and then we get tired and we fall asleep. That's the mentality of an ass. That's a donkey's mentality. The mentality of somebody with subtle vision is that, why is this happening to me? Why is this happening to me? Like if anybody tries to stay awake, you know, for a few days, why am I forced to sleep? And if somebody tries to sleep for days on end, why am I forced to wake up? Why am I being forced from one state to another state? We're supposed to analyze why are these things being forced upon me? And then observe that I'm the witness of these states. And when I become the witness of these states, then we can see that all these three states accumulated come under the banner of ahankar, false ego. So we're supposed to give up this false ego and surrender to Krishna. So the point is that Mother Ganges, the accumulated, the accumulated karma, like everybody's karma all mixed together, all the basanas all mixed together, collective karma all together. She's been touched by the toe of Lord Vishnu, so she's agitated because she's karma basanas. She's unlimited karma basanas, impressions there. She's been touched by the toe of Lord Vishnu. So therefore she's pure. She's so purified that when she touched the bodies of the sons of Sagara Maharaj, they became rejuvenated and went to the heavenly planets. She's purified. But previously, in text 6, no, in text 5, she expressed her fear. She said, I do not wish to go down to the planet Earth, for there the people in general will bathe in my water to cleanse themselves of the reactions of their sinful deeds. When all these sinful reactions accumulate in me, how shall I become free from them? You must consider this very carefully. So she expressed her fear that she'll become contaminated when sinful people bathe in her waters. So if we take that her waters are also representative of our consciousness, our subtle body, then when other people, when materialistic people come and bathe in our waters, then we become contaminated. That should be a fear of ours. Bathe in our water means when we associate, if we let people in to our mind, to our consciousness, then that has an effect. Just by associating with materialistic people or sinful people, we accumulate the reactions of other people's sinful activities. Our minds become covered over, and we become averse to the process of devotional service. So, Maharaj Bhagirath replies, he says that the pure devotees, when the sadhus come and bathe in your water, then because they carry the Supreme Personality of Godhead in their heart, who can vanquish sinful reactions, when they bathe in your waters, then you'll be purified of the sinful reactions. So what's the point for us is that we're supposed to be afraid of associating with materialistic people because we become contaminated. So what's the solution? The solution is to associate with sadhus. Let the sadhus come and bathe in our waters. So how do we do that? It's explained that in order to allow sadhus to come in, we have to associate with the sadhus through hearing is how you do it. You hear the message, Sushusho Shadadanasya Vasudeva Kata Ruchi, Sian Mahatse Vyavipra, Punya Tirtha Nisevanat. When one serves the pure devotees, great service is done. By serving the pure devotees, one develops a taste for hearing the message of Vasudeva. Then Srinvatam Swakata Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtana, Hridyanta Stoji Abhadrani, Vidunoti Suhritsatam. Means that if we satisfy the pure devotee, we develop a taste for hearing his message. We develop a taste for hearing about Krishna consciousness. And by developing that taste, then Krishna in our heart, he purifies the heart of anartas. So that's how it's all connected. He purifies from within. He kills the demons within. He purifies our anartas. And through that purification, Nasta Prayeshu Badreshu Nityam Bhagavata Seveya Bhagavati Uttamashloke Bhakti Bhavati Naishtiki. Naishtiki Bhakti comes. Naishtiki Bhakti means when the anartas are cleared off, when the demons are killed, then Naishtiki Bhakti, Nishta comes. And from Nishta, there's rapid advancement to Prema, Bhava and Prema. So the point is, like one point from this pastime is that we should see that what's very important in this pastime is that the pure devotees bathe in the Ganges River and they purify the Ganges River. So the pure devotees can purify our consciousness if we allow them to bathe in our waters. It's up to us to open up our heart to the message of the sadhus and associate in that way. And if we do that, then we clear the path for development in Krishna consciousness. So I'll finish there, I've gone over time, sorry. Srimad Bhagavatam Mahapuranam Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. If there's any questions or comments,